somebody to come and do a presentation. So, you know, we've taught that if we're always doing the same thing, you'll get bored and you won't come anymore. So it's a way of seeing you. So I'll do a quick review, project status, talking about the mass password change. Ryan will come and tell us about the mass password change, updates and upgrades, and we'll have the presentation. And after a question period for whomever wants to ask questions. So, we recently finished four projects. So, I think a lot of people, especially in HR, they seem to have crammed a lot of projects before all our new retirees left. So we did the pension, we did the biweekly payroll, we did pay equity, so it was extremely busy in that area. What's the good news is that all those projects finished on time. And I'm looking at Angie because she was partly responsible for that. So we finished on time and it worked well, they worked well. So pension, I don't know if some of you went to see the website. For the new pension environment, really interesting, really nice. You could do simulations and all sorts of stuff and see when we hope you will not retire. So we have enough retirement for a while. And finally, eStore was also implemented, I think, a few weeks ago. That's for enrollment services, providing different services online for students. We also have some ongoing projects. So there's a non-credit activity management program. That's for the continuous study group, the faculty. So that is also led by Angie. We have the G2. G2, a lot of people don't know what G2 is, but it is extremely important for all of us because it brings half the revenue to McGill. So it is a really interesting system for all of us because it's part of the money that helps pay us. IT service management, so the ITSM, so that's going to replace Heat and other ticketing systems. That's an ongoing project. Content management, the Documentum upgrade, that's also an ongoing project, a bit longer than we expected. We customize too much, so it takes us more time when we want to upgrade. Also, same thing for Drupal. Banner Horizon, that one is red. We're having issues with it. It's taking us more time than we planned. SideQuest, invoice integration, that's going well. The dentistry move, I don't know if you know, but the clinic of dentistry is moving from the MUHC to a locale on Sherbrooke. So that's significant work, especially on the NCS side. In terms of moving them and installing them in their new environment. And phase two for exchange and study away. That's something we also finished. We finished the phase one and that was implemented also a few weeks ago. We have upcoming projects. So ITSM is going along. We should be doing the call for tender, I hope, soon. ITEM's also going along. That's the monitoring system for our different applications and infrastructure. The banner database extension. That was interesting because that's the first part of the banner upgrade. So I know I've received a question. Somebody sent me a written question on that. We're going to start, we already started an overview that everything that's in the banner upgrade to version 9. Sue and Shelley went to the Aleutian conference to get information on their roadmap and what were this, but also to talk to other universities that have done that upgrade because it's a significant one. It's a change of technology. Currently, most of banner is done, I think, with forms, Oracle forms, and they're moving to Groovy on Grails. So. That is significant. When you have a platform change from one version to the other, it's always massive. And there's a lot of preliminary work. We have to reconfigure the databases to fit with the new environment, and that will be the first phase. So Sue will be working with Orial, but also with the people in ISR to build the program and identify what will be the steps. Then each step will be handled as a project. We'll find a project manager in the PMO to handle that. But that should be an initiative that will take quite a few years for us to go through the student and the financial upgrade. We're still hoping that we won't have to do the HR upgrade because we're still hoping that we'll be able to do R2R. Then there's a system, there's travel management. There should be a call for tender sometimes in the next few months to choose a system to handle all travel at McGill expenses and expense reports. Supplies manager, management inventory for dentistry. So that's going to be kind of probably a first phase of inventory deployment. So it is something that is available, if I remember correctly, in PsychWest. So we will deploy it first in dentistry and gradually with people who have inventory of you know, supplies that you consume so that you have to renew on a regular basis. So not asset management, but really perishables. Then we're also finishing the budget for the network project. We've also started to work on the presentation that will be done to the board. That we have two projects that are significant in terms of financial outlay, R2R and the network upgrade and the telephony upgrade. So we need to go for the board for them for those. And yesterday we had our first working sessions in terms of building the presentation that will be done to go and get the budget for those. So that's good news in the sense that we got the go-ahead from the budget committee. The budget committee is composed of the provost, Michael DeGrappa, who's the VP Admin and Finance, and the principal. So we've got the go-ahead to go and present those projects to the board, which is a good thing. ID management, identity management, we'll probably start that one. We want to do it chunk by chunk and kind of get quick wins. The first thing I would like us to implement in that initiative is the password management before tackling identity, which is a very complex thing to do. The thing that currently is causing us the most pain from a help desk perspective is password changes. So having a good system in place to do that will certainly help us. There's a project that's going to start or already started for athletics. And finally, we're about to sign the Office 365 contract. So yeah, a year and a half later. So that one was really long. From a legal perspective, we wanted to make sure that the contract respected all the Quebec legislation around privacy and around intellectual property. So that is finally over. We got an email 2 weeks ago from the lawyers saying that they have finished agreeing on the last little piece of the contract. And so we should be able to sign it in the next few weeks and start working. We will start by deploying for students, and then we'll look into deploying for faculty and staff. That's going to be a little bit more complicated from a technical viewpoint because we also need to convert eVault. So, and that's not obvious from what I'm being told. So these are the projects that are coming up. And I'll let Ryan talk about the password change.
Thanks, Ghislaine. So as you all know, we had the Heartbleed vulnerability that was discovered, was it in March? Probably one of the biggest security vulnerabilities sort of discovered in the last, you know, 2 to 2 years maybe. So as a result, one of the things that we're going to be asking almost the entire community to do is to reset their McGill credentials or McGill password. Not everyone will be asked to do it as sort of a mandatory thing. Some will be voluntary, but sort of as a best practice, we're sort of recommending that all users reset their password. So for academic staff, it will be voluntary but highly recommended. Non-academic and administrative staff will be voluntary but mandatory from a policy standpoint. When we say voluntary, it means that we're not going to be enforcing it from a technology standpoint. We're not going to be locking accounts or forcing a password reset on next login, just due to the complexity of the way in which our sort of identity management works and our passwords work. But there will be an announcement in all likelihood coming from both the provost and VP admin. Students there again would be voluntary but highly recommended. Alumni, voluntary but not required. That's mostly due to the fact that most of the systems that alumni still have access to were not deemed vulnerable. Resource accounts. These are the accounts used by, you know, shared accounts used by staff and also used for the administration of certain systems, would be voluntary but mandatory from a policy standpoint, and we would actually enforce management through compliance reporting. So we would actually generate reports and see, you know, if a password resource account hasn't been reset, we would be sort of following, chasing after those people with that communication. Just a sort of success story here. One of the big fears with this whole exercise, this is the first time we're doing this on such a large scale, upwards of, well, if you include alumni, you know, it's tens of thousands of users. If we include the immediate community, probably closer to 10,000 users. That's a lot of users all out being asked to reset their password at the same time. Now, the resetting of the password is not that complicated. It's the resyncing or changing your password on all your devices, your Wi-Fi and your laptop, your iPhone, your Kindle, your iPad, and what have you. And the way in which our systems are designed, if you try to log in with the wrong password a number of times, the account will become locked. So if you go into Minerva or Reggie and reset your password, you do it, the iPhone still keeps trying to hammer the system with the old password, and what happens is it'll lock the account. So, you know, we're trying to figure out how we're going to deal with that, because if all these users go in and reset their password and their iPhone or their iPad or their laptop lock the account, they're going to be calling into the service desk to have their accounts reset. We're worried we're going to get flooded. So actually someone in NCS, Sylvain Hamel, had a suggestion to enable something called password history, which would allow, if you know, at first we weren't sure if it was going to work, but we've done some testing now, we're pretty confident it's going to work. It makes it so that if you reset your password and try to log in using an old password, as long as it's a good old password, it won't lock the account. It won't let you in, so the iPhone still won't get its mail until you change the password, but that old password won't count towards locking your account, which is fantastic news. So really save the day there. So we're going to be sending out communications to the community within the next week or so. We're asking that IT services be the sort of first guinea pigs, so please keep an eye out for that email. We're going to be asking all of you to be part of the first wave of resetting your passwords, and so just keep an eye out for that. Thank you. Oh, the next is me too. All right. Nope. Upgrades and okay, yeah, I guess it is, sorry. Seeing the next slide? I'm doing it. So before you read that, I just want to sort of explain what the next few slides are about. I asked Guylaine if we could do a bit of a public service announcement today. We had an incident a couple of weeks ago where a software update was sort of pushed by accident that affected close to 2,000 computers on campus. And the way in which, so it, as a result, we had a lot of users that were affected. It was affecting email and Office. And as a result, our desktop support team had to sort of scramble to try and repair the problem. And the system that we used to do that, it's called SCCM, It allows us to sort of push in an automated fashion updates, patches, software patches, and so on. We do that, we want to do that automated because we're dealing with a large number of machines. We don't want to have the user, we don't want to have user intervention required, and we don't want to send a technician on site for, say, 2,000, 10,000 computers or whatever. So we use SCCM to do that, and so we script those updates. Now, some of those updates, some of those patches are completely transparent, can happen while the machine is on, while the user is logged in, no problem. Some updates, though, are more invasive and require a reboot at the end. So because a reboot is required, we don't want to interrupt someone's work. So if the user is logged in, the machine is on, they're logged in, the assumption is there's somebody behind the screen, maybe doing work, and we don't want to interrupt that. So the way in which we script those updates is that we require that the machine be logged off, but on. And the trouble that we've sort of run into on an ongoing basis is that sometimes our users don't know the difference between logged off, logged on, locked, shut down. And because of the way that the updates are scripted, you know, those updates aren't going to work unless they're logged off. So we prepared a bit of a PSA to sort of explain the difference. Because this is something that, you know, it's not, IT isn't immune to this. So the power has to be on, but you have to be logged off. Okay? So it's different from locking your computer, it's different from shutting down your computer. They're all different states. So what we need is that the machine be logged off. And sort of the last slide is sort of a best practice. A lot of our updates will only, you know, there's updates going out all the time for all of our managed computers. If you're a user that never logs off, your machine will never get those updates. And even myself, sometimes I forget to log off at the end of the night. And I try to remember, you know, at least once or twice a week to actually log off instead of just locking the computer. So please know the difference. And that's it. I hand it back to Gilan, or, yeah? Or is it now the guest speaker? No?
one. So today, like Guylaine mentioned, we will do a little bit different from this presentation compared to the other town hall. So we are very pleased to have our guest speaker, Dr. Camille Zacquier, which is Dr. Zacquier is responsible of the psychology department in the Douglas Institute. So he's been working for many years here and is working on a very interesting project. He's also be responsible of some people, helping people with about their emotional problem. He's also have a good institute where he's having Allo J'écoute. There's also, he's writing very good article in the Metro Journal and the Journal 24 Heures. So we strongly invite you to go and read some very quick article. Sorry, Metro. Sorry. Anyway, they're competing. Yes, exactly. No, Metro.
No, Metro.
The Metro one.
There's one this morning, actually.
So I strongly invite you to read some articles. So very pleased today to talk to you, to introduce having Dr. Zacquier talking today. He will talk about the stress we're going through, the change we went through over the last 2 years. So I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Zacquier.
Thank you. Merci, Lucy. I feel a little bit low over here because I tend to walk around, so I asked for a cordless mic. Is there a reason why we don't have this side over here? Last time I was in this room, in the late 1970s, early 1980s, I think I was writing a stats exam, so I feel a little bit nervous being here. You might be interested to know that, since you're IT people, that I typed my master's thesis on a manual typewriter, but I typed my doctoral thesis on an Apple IIe, that box that Steve Jobs held up once. Anyway, so thanks for having me. I'm going to, actually I was asked to cover a number of topics. We're here for a couple of hours. Don't worry, you'll have a pee break at some point. I think that we mostly wanted to talk about stress management, burnout, those kinds of things, which is very common in most work environments these days. At the same time, how to manage change, and you know, when you're dealing with a changing environment all the time, there's conflicts, and so we throw in a little bit of discussing conflicts and self-confidence as well. So we've got four different topics, but basically I've divided up into two parts. We'll do stress management first, and then we'll talk about confidence and managing change and getting along and being lovey-dovey after the break, okay? So here's some of the, this is a stretched out image, I think, huh? That's all right. What is stress? So it'll only matter when you see my picture up there. What is stress? Why and when does it cause burnout? How can we best adapt to change? How can we build self-confidence? And how can we better get along? Is that some of the stuff you were hoping to cover, Lucy? Okay. That, and at the same time, we're going to clean the environment and do everything else in it. Okay, so first part is stress and burnout. So what is stress? We often think of stress as something bad, but the reality is stress is simply any challenge to the body. And the stress response is what the body does in response to any kind of challenge, right? So you need to have a normal stress response. Otherwise, when it snows, you're not going to slow down when you're driving. So any form of challenge to the person is stressful. Of course, it depends on the degree, right? It can be felt as anxiety when it's very acute, or as general tension when diffuse and chronic. So the reality is that the anxiety response, a panic attack, those kinds of things, is just the stress response in a more sharp or acute way. When is something stressful? Here's a little acronym we're going to visit throughout this morning's talk. It's NUTS. I didn't come up with it. NUTS, something that is novel. So any novelty, and why would novelty be stressful? Because you don't know what to expect. So when you don't know what to expect, you need to be more alert. Very obvious, very simple. Unpredictability. Again, if you don't know what's going to happen, if you have a you know, a rabid dog around you. You don't know if he'll leap at you or how close you can get and so on. So, of course, you're going to be a little more alert. It has to be threatening. Obviously, if there's no potential harm, it's not going to matter. If you're going into a forest and there's only kittens, it's not too threatening. But if there's lions and tigers, of course, it is threatening and so on. Same thing with eating some foreign object that you think is tainted and you're starving to death and there's some mushrooms in the forest. Do you eat them? Well, obviously you're going to be more scared because it's threatening. And finally, and this is probably a key for most of us, a sense of control is lost. So when you have control over a threat, you're less stressed. When you don't have, you know, if you go into a forest, I talk about forests and cavemen because that's where we came from, right? So if you think about the stress response, you're going into a new place, you don't know what's out there. You don't know if you're going to get lost, if there's cliffs, if there's predators and so on. Anything could happen. If there's a potential a thunderstorm coming, you don't know if there's going to be a lightning clap that'll hit you. Of course, you know, you can get lost, starve to death, die, have to eat your neighbor, whatever it is. Well, just make sure you bring a fat buddy when you get into a forest. And of course, if you go in there and you have a compass and you have a gun and you have all these other things, then you have some control over what can happen. The more control you have, the more prepared you are. So the natural response when we're threatened is to prepare ourselves. How do you prepare yourself if it's unpredictable? How do you prepare yourself if it isn't known? How do you prepare yourself if you have no means of doing it, if you have no control, right? So those are the things that are threatening in a forest, but we'll visit the IT world in a little bit, okay? So here's a simple formula for stress. There are things that challenge us and things that make us less stressed. In other words, there are things that add to our stress and things that reduce our stress. Number one, obviously, is the challenges we face. And the other thing is, how do we respond to those challenges? In other words, the more stuff we have to deal with, I guess my little pointer isn't very bright, but on the left side, the more stuff we have to deal with, the more challenging things are, the more stressed we're going to be, the more tools we have to respond to them, the better it is. So if I ask people to write a letter, if I ask you guys at 9 o'clock in the morning, to write a letter, and I say, you have till noon, please write a letter of reference for a colleague. How many of you would be stressed? Probably not that many. 3 hours should be plenty of time to write a letter. On the other hand, there are people in this room who don't have any confidence in their writing ability. Maybe it's a language issue. Maybe they are the kinds of people who write a sentence and then cross it out and start again, and cross it out and start again, and then they write a paragraph, and then they crumple up the paper and start all over again. You can just imagine if you're that kind of person, that even one letter is going to be pretty stressful. So obviously, even though there's not a big challenge, the person has a very limited ability to deal with it, or their perception of how to deal with it is affected. On the other hand, if I say, even to the most confident person, listen, we've got to rush, I need 10 letters of reference between now and noon. Go. Then, of course, you'd all be more stressed. So the bottom line is that it isn't always a question of what you have to do. It's also a question of how you can manage it. So challenges add stress. Mastery over those challenges reduce stress. But there is no finite amount, right? Even a person who masters things well can be stressed when they have too much crap on their plate. And even a person who doesn't have a lot can be very stressed because of lack of confidence and so on and so forth. Okay? Of course, that creates stress. All right. I'm going to go up here. Easier to read my own writing. No two people react the same way to a similar stressor, and that's important, right? It's important because the reality is the stress response is an individual response. The stress response is an interaction between the challenge itself and the individual's perception of his or her ability to respond to it. The key word in that sentence is perception. Because a person could be a lousy writer. And if they think they're good, they're not going to be stressed by a letter. A person could be a brilliant writer, but have no confidence and keeps questioning their sentence over and over again, that person is going to be more stressed. So perception of ability is the key. In other words, and this is just the same thing in a different way, stress increases when our challenges increase, right? Or when we perceive them that way. Because a challenge is not something that is concrete and finite. A challenge is something that is perceived. Okay? Stress diminishes when we have the tools or the means to respond to them, or we think we do. Okay? Like, I could be up here really freaking out because I don't have self-confidence, or I can be very calm and relaxed and still be a crappy speaker. So the bottom line is, my perceptions of my abilities are going to have a big impact on how I react to it. So you can ask two people to do the same thing. Could you guys do this software? Could you create this, or could you give a little presentation? And the two people will not be in the same boat, regardless of their circumstances and regardless of their abilities as well. Okay. When we talk about stress, obviously people talk about burnout and so on. A lot of people go on burnout leaves or stress leaves. And burnout isn't a scientific term. It's a popular term that we use whenever someone isn't functioning normally. And it can sometimes be used interchangeably with depression. It could sometimes be just a person's fed up. It could be a conflict at work. It could be an HR issue. There's all those kinds of things. So it's vague enough that it's often misunderstood. But in general, if we limit ourselves to talking about burnout as something that is essentially a situation where the person isn't functioning as they normally would, and here are some of the symptoms. And of course, it doesn't necessarily have to be related to work. When a person isn't doing well at home, they tend to say they're depressed. When they're not doing well at work, they tend to say they're burnt out. But anyway, bottom line is, it focuses more on function or disability or inability to function. So you look at this, anxiety, we all feel anxiety. Frustration, we all feel frustration. And go, hey, I got that. Okay. Obviously, these are indicators. And if you think about sense of futility, what's the point? You're agitated, fatigued, frustrated. And look at the last three. Impatience, pessimism, and loss of productivity. If you think about those, a lot of people are frustrated. A lot of people are pessimistic. A lot of people are impatient. But if normally you're a patient person, if normally you're very optimistic and hopeful, and now you start talking about what's the point, and this is just a lot of crap, and blah, 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 or your productivity has dropped. In other words, pay particular attention within yourselves or your colleagues whenever there is a drop, okay? Whenever there is a change. You know, whenever I start to snap at home, my wife always says, you need a vacation. And she's sometimes right, sometimes she's just being difficult herself, but I prefer the second interpretation of that. But occasionally she's right, and that usually is an indication. And you'll notice when you come home with the kids, right? You know, mom or dad has been home with the kids all the time, and then at the end of the day, they just want to go, you come home, what's the big deal here? Let me wipe your face for you, this kind of stuff. Because, of course, you've been away, so you're not stressed. So obviously, when you start losing patience, it's because it's there, okay? So what causes burnout? What makes us, what brings us to that point? This is not an exhaustive scientific list. These are some of the factors that I think are key. One is we expect too much of ourselves, okay? Now, there's a lot of people who always want to get ahead. You know, the person says, I want to go to night school and get an MBA. I want to make extra money. I got to go to the gym, get my black belt in karate, and so on and so forth. I want to redo my deck. I got to paint my house. We all have these kinds of projects. And where do they come from? Sometimes they come out of necessity, and they're all great ideas. But how much is enough? And so most of the time, or not most of the time, but many times, pressure to do more or to take on more is internally generated. Okay? And generally, you know, you people are educated, and educated people tend to want to learn, and they're curious, and so on and so forth. And of course, you watch Oprah, and have to suddenly exercise and eat well every day, and eat, you know, eat certain berries, and so on. So a lot of it also comes from us, okay? Except it doesn't always come from us. It comes often as well from others. So pressures come from the outside. Managers ask you to do such and such, colleagues ask you for help, neighbors ask for lifts and those kinds of things. And so, of course, nobody ever says, it's too much. If you go to the store to buy a pair of shoes and they're $100, and then you go next door and they're $50, you're going to say, no, let me give you $100. Because next door they're charging $100. Nobody's going to do that. You're always going to try and get as much as possible for the money. And if you're working in a factory, it's the same kind of things. And if you can do, you know, come up with a software fix in 2 hours, somebody else can do it in 1 hour, they're going to always try and get as much as possible out of you. And in our society, we have a tendency now, especially since free trade, is to set management by objectives. And so we're going to have so many in sales. And if you sell for $100,000 in this month, the next month they're not going to say, well, the objective is going to be $80,000. The objective is always going to be, well, let's see if you can do 110 and 120 and so on, because we want to see what the maximum is. Well, what is the maximum? If a person says, I'm working hard, I'm working well, that's enough, they've reached their maximum. If a person feels as if they have to achieve the goal, every time you up the goal, they keep pushing, and it's just a question of time before people crack if there isn't a limit. Then there is the self-perception of it's never good enough. The perfectionists, the ones who write a sentence and rewrite that sentence, and so on and so forth. One of my clients actually works in IT, not in this department, and on burnout, is really a very, very smart man. Always did well in school, but never felt as if he was very smart. So with him, it was always a question of trying to, you know, prove himself because of lack of confidence. And because of that, well, not just because of that, but also he has very, very high standards. And to him, when he's working on a software, even though it's working, he's always trying to maximize and optimize. And that's your world, right? Trying to optimize as much as possible the work that's being done, because that is what we all want. Except, at what point, if he can get it to work after 10 hours of work, and he can get it more efficient after 15 hours of work, but he can spend another 30 hours of work to really get it as smooth as possible, at what point are you losing productivity out of an effort to overdo it? So, again, there isn't a limit, and in some jobs you want precision. You know, I want the next guy to build the Champlain Bridge to have high standards. I'm okay with that. Take all the time you need. Same thing with airplanes and so on. But there are other things that are not so important, and the problem sometimes is that many of us always feel like it's not good enough, and we want to apply the same standards to every challenge. You know, the perfectionists, and there's many in this room. Then there is a lack of confidence, the feeling like you're an imposter. Okay, how many people here feel like imposters? You don't have to raise your hands, but I'm sure that if you look around the room, 9 out of 10 people think that you're smarter than them. Or that there's 9 out of 10 people think that everyone else is smarter than they are. And why does that happen? Well, you know, if a teacher asks a question, somebody raises their hand and answers the question, and you don't know the answer, she's smarter than me.
Teacher asks another question. Somebody else raises their hand. And you don't know that one either. He's smarter than me too. And pretty soon, you know, everyone else seems to know stuff that you don't know. The problem is that when you raise your hand and you have an answer, whew, I got lucky there. There's other people, the ones that answer the other question go, she's smarter than me. Or he's smarter than me. You go to meetings. I go to meetings. You know, I get my documents. And I'm supposed to have read them all. We all swear we read all the stuff in preparation for the meeting. And I go to board meetings. I have this much. I have this much to read. I flip through it like a normal human being. Except there's always someone at the meeting said, on page 42, line 7, you're missing an accent. What the F is wrong with you? And there's those kinds of people. And, you know, you go to meetings and you really are totally unprepared. And you go, man, everyone else is prepared and not me. A normal human being doesn't prepare. I hate to say that. Of course, we try. We do our best. And I'm not that unprepared, but most of the time. And I used to go to read books and halfway through a page, I wasn't paying attention. I was thinking of my stomach. Because that's what we do, right? Or think of something else in our lives. And then after someone's reading, you know, talking about what they loved about the book, and you go, man, oh man, did they read the same book as me? We all do this, right? I used to go to meetings and leave the meeting going, man, I totally missed the boat there. I don't understand anything the guy said. Then one day I had a liberating thought. I said, wait a second here. I managed to get a doctorate from McGill, not bad, not great, I mean lots of people do, but nevertheless I figured, okay, I'm smart enough. And now I go to meetings, and if I don't understand the presentation, rather than assuming everyone else understands and I don't, I say, well, let me check. Maybe if I'm relatively smart and I don't understand, tons of other relatively smart people also don't understand. So I say, did you understand anything that was said? Nope. Okay, just checking. So the reality is we're all in the same boat for a simple reason. People talk about what they know. So we hear what they know. We assume they know everything we know plus all this other stuff that we don't. The reality is they just know different stuff than us. So it's very easy, especially when we talk about, you know, objectives and this and that and principles and... trust me, we're all in the same boat, okay? And finally, and this is an important thing, sometimes there's just a bad fit between us, the skills we have, and what we need for the job. The problem is that people often think that if they don't have these skills, they don't belong there in the whole company or in the whole department, the whole university or whatever it is. And that's not the case. It's rarely the case. Sometimes it is just a bad fit with those particular skills. If I had to work somewhere where I had to, you know, manage the social media. What the hell is social media? I don't know what. I never tweet. I tweeted 3 times in my life just because people want to know, when am I giving a talk? So now we put it on Twitter. And I have a Twitter joke for later. I'll save that. Well, I'll tell you right now, I don't tweet. Period. Once in a while, I have a cold. If I have a cold and I have a nostril that's blocked, the other one might whistle a little bit. I don't know if that counts as tweeting, but that's about as far as I go with it. Okay, that's my Twitter joke. But again, or for example, if I had to write in French, I do publish in Metro, but it's a translation. If I had to actually work for a paper, I'd be out of my element. So sometimes we think that we have to be able to do it all. The reality is that nobody has all the skills. And there's plenty of room for your skills in any large department and so on. So all of this, basically, you have internally generated pressures, pressures coming from the outside. You have your sense of perfectionism, the feeling like it's never good enough. The poor self-esteem or the imposter syndrome. Missing skills or poor fit. And of course, the result is not unusual. And of course, if any of you have been through this, you kind of can see where exactly it went wrong, right? Now we'll put the stress and this formula together now. So, let me remind you of, See, I couldn't find the division on my computer before. I finally found it and I corrected on the other one. But basically, it's an interaction. It's not a multiplication. So number of responsibilities increases stress. How we handle them decreases stress. Okay? So, if there are a lot of expectations coming from yourself, I should go to the gym 5 times a week, I should lose weight, I should read books, I should do Sudokus because I got to protect my memory, I got to do crosswords, I got to do this and that and so on and so forth. Well, a lot of pressure comes from yourself. If you can't recognize your own limits, your own time, your own need for energy and space and relaxation and whatever, then that's just going to keep increasing. Then, of course, can you give me a lift? Can you do this other project? Can you help out? Can you train the new guy? Can you take over this department? Blah, 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 blah. If you can't say no, if you can't stop people, that just increases. So if you think about this, if there, again, I don't have my pointer here, but I'm going to try something radical. I carry batteries with me. If you think about that side of the equation, that left side of the equation, you have the generation of pressure, the pressures from the outside and from the inside, and you have the brakes. If you have no brakes, there you go. If you have no brakes, this just keeps increasing. If you have a lot of expectations on yourself and you don't recognize your limits, you want to do it all, this keeps increasing. So if there's nothing that limits that, what's going to happen? It's just a question of you keep doing more and more and more until boom, you can't do it anymore. So it's inevitable that you're going to burn out if there are no limits, no breaks. Then you have, sometimes you have lack of necessary skills, so then it doesn't take very much to make you crack. Or you don't have the support, either financial support, support from your spouses, support from your colleagues, support from your managers, from your staff, from whatever. Lack of confidence, high standards, feeling like it's never good enough. Now, I want you to just take a look at this slide here and ask yourself, if you're feeling overly stressed, what is your source of stress? Okay? Some people have a lot of stress because they just want too much for themselves. Some people are always saying yes, trying to please everyone. And that desire to please people is a basic personality trait that we all have in different degrees. So the more you are agreeable, which is the trait we're talking about, the harder it is to say no, and then that just keeps piling on. Is it because, you know, there's something missing? Is it because you do a good job but you don't believe in yourself? Is it because you have these crazy high standards that are never going to be met? So if you feel excessively stressed, ask yourself, what's my problem here? Where is my source? And the source could be internal, as I said, your confidence, your standards. The source could be your expectations. The source could be, you know, what's coming to you and your inability to limit that and so on. All right. There are two additional causes of burnout. What I have discussed so far is really stress, expectations, and so on, and it could lead to pretty serious depression. I think it's important to recognize that. However, it's not always because of that. About, I don't know, half the cases of burnout are more HR issues than anything else. And I think we need to acknowledge that. Sometimes you get burnt out because of that. With all due respect to the bosses, sometimes, you know, if a person is difficult to please, if they have the high standards, high expectations, or they're disorganized, or they give you an assignment, like this guy who got burnt out, by the way, was put on an assignment that he knew was not going to work, and everyone in his department knew it was going to work. Even his manager knew it wasn't going to work. And it was just a waste of time, but they had to do it to please the board because it came from above. And so even his own manager told him, do this, it's no use, it's going to go in the garbage afterwards. So how motivated do you think this guy was? And that was the straw that broke the camel's back for this guy. Except Inanna was the other person. Sometimes the problem is you. Okay? Now, why do I have this slide here? I have this slide here because it's like talking about welfare. There are people who cheat on welfare. And yet there are also many people who are mentally ill, who are suffering, who don't have the abilities, or in horrible social situations, who need our support. And if you lump everyone together, then you disrespect the people who need your support. So, unfortunately, the problem with burnout is a lot of times, you know, people who are having a hard time or in conflict, they go off on leave, and then when other people who really are cracking need to go off, they feel guilty. And then when they do go off, they have to face stigma and judgment, and they often face the failure of not having been able to do it, which often feeds their depression and so on and so forth. So let's acknowledge that, yeah, there are some cases where the person's being difficult. Or sometimes they're in a situation where they have to work for a difficult person. But that doesn't mean that that's the cause. So out of respect for your colleagues or yourselves, if you are in that situation, you know, don't blame people. Sometimes it's because they have too much stress and they have too much expectations and so on and so forth. Okay? So that's why the term burnout could refer to so many things, and it's important to acknowledge that so that we can manage it. Okay. Now, we talked earlier that stress is a subjective thing. It's felt differently by each person. We all have our, what we call cognitive schemas. We all have our core beliefs, our fundamental beliefs about ourselves and the world. If we think the world is unfair, every time something bad happens, you see, life sucks. If we think people are nice, when someone opens the door for you, oh, people are so nice. If you think people are mean, every time someone cuts you off in traffic, it's people are jerks. We have a tendency to have these filters through which we interpret things. So let me give you a couple of examples. What do you call those little Italian coffees there? This thing? Is it espresso? Or espresso? Sorry. I had a guy. His manager asked me to see him because his employee was in bad shape. He was depressed. He was talking suicide. So his manager said, could you see the guy? I said, okay. I had him come to my office, and he's telling me about how much of a failure his life was. He basically is saying, look, you know, I'm just a cleaner. Nobody knows my name. I go down the hall. Nobody knows me. You know, I never finished. I never went to university. Blah, blah, blah. And even my brother thinks I'm stupid. So I said, why do you say that? He said, well, the other day I asked him for an espresso. And he told me it's espresso. Okay? So that's the story. Now, how would you feel if you asked someone for an espresso and they corrected you? And if you type it in on a Word document, it's going to be underlined in red. All right. So how would you feel? Well, there's lots of ways of interpreting that. It's an event, right? An event is interpreted. A person could say, well, I can explain to you, but it's an Italian word. There's no X in the Italian alphabet. There's no J. There's no Y. So Yolanda is spelled I-O-L, and Giovanna is spelled G-I, and so on and so forth. And Giuseppe, my father's Giuseppe, his name is G-I-U, Seppi. So it's an Italian word. It means fast, quick, espresso. There you go. It's an espresso. Okay, you could take it as interesting information. Or you could take it as, who gives a rat's ass? Half the world says espresso. including, by the way, most Italians. And because Italians translate the word, they will say, I had another client, I swear to you, at the same time, who owned and operated an espresso bar. Come to my shop, I'll make you a nice espresso. That's what he kept saying to me, right? If you go to Palais de Congrès, there's a restaurant there that says sandwich, espresso. It's written espresso. I want to take a picture of it to prove to people. The fact is that a lot of people say espresso. It's pretty interchangeable, and language evolves and so on. The reason Italians use the word espresso is because they're translating the word from fast to express, right? So, you can also say, man, this guy's being picky. He's being a jerk. Or you can say, oh my God, I'm such an idiot. The truth is, I think most of us would pretty well disregard that. You're walking along, give me an espresso, whatever, give me the coffee. Right? This guy is going about his life, his normal business, like the rest of you. He says espresso, his brother corrects him, boom, hits him in the guts like a ton of bricks, like a punch in the guts. Why? Because of his belief. His belief is, I am a failure. And so he's looking around for proof. Aha, see? In other words, we can interpret things anyway. Someone looks at us, doesn't look at us, asks us to do something, doesn't. When we're dealing with depression, when we're dealing with anxiety, when we're dealing with burnout, it isn't just the events that matter. It's what do the events represent. If the person thought he was an idiot, there you go, he found the perfect example of it. If a person has self-confidence, he disregards it. And that happens to everyone. Happens to all of us. We have our filters. Pardon the pun. You can laugh at this part. The same guy, you'll notice that he said, nobody even knows my name. I'm just a cleaner. I go down the hallway. And I'm thinking, well, you know what? Nobody knows me. And I basically know too many people down the hall either. So I saw him 4 times. Just as a crisis intervention, I see him, and he was not a real client. What I mean by that is, I didn't have a file on him. I didn't open the drawer and take out his file, see his name, and write his name on a progress note, or put it back in the chart and put it back in alphabetical order. So I just scribbled his name in my agenda. I saw him 4 times. 2 years later, I run into him in the park. Watching a little league game. We start chatting and chatting. After five minutes, he looks me in the eye and says, do you remember my name? Who does that? Jeez, I swear to you, I regularly forget the name of my own children. Swear to you. Out of some miracle of, I don't know, planetary alignment, quantum mechanics, whatever it is, I happen to remember his name. Yeah, you're so-and-so. So I thought, man, what was this guy doing? He was testing, right? He was testing, am I important? And if I remembered, well, of course, as my psychologist. Imagine if I had forgotten. See, even my goddamn shrink forgot my name. I'm telling you this story because it's about selective attention. Selective attention happens in all of us whenever we have a belief, a prejudice. You see it in racism, you see it in sexism, ageism, whatever, okay? You know, all men are pigs. Okay, that one's true, but... No. Well, he's so nice, why he's not typical? This kind of stuff, right? Or women are, or, you know, Asians, or blacks, or whites, or Muslims, or whatever. We all have our, and you can see it when someone generalizes, and when someone dismisses things that don't fit their prejudice, and yeah, see, they underline whenever something does. But those things also happen towards ourselves. A lot of people feel that they are a failure, or they are this, or they are that, or that people don't like them. When someone says something nice, well, they're being nice. When someone says something not so nice, it's because they don't like me. So we all do this. We all carry around our baggage. We all carry around our beliefs, and the more we believe them, the more we confirm those things. So a prejudice is self-confirming. And unless you are aware of your own prejudices, you're not going to overcome them. And once again, the prejudice against ourselves are the ones that I'm referring to. But it applies to all of them. Let me give you this other example. You have two people in class, two students in class. They're both equally bright students. They both have the same GPAs. They both do well. They both study just as hard. Everyone agrees they're really matched. Except that one of them has self-confidence and one of them doesn't. Okay? Teacher asks a question to both students. Neither of them know the answer. How does Mr. Self-Confidence deal with that?
Well, I don't know.
End of story, right? How does the one without self-confidence take that? Oh, I'm such an idiot. Teacher asks him a second question. They both know the answer. Mr. Self-Confidence says, yes. Mr. No Self-Confidence says, whew. So what do, right? The one with confidence misses a question, doesn't matter, it's a tough question or teacher's being difficult or whatever. And when they get one that's correct, it confirms, yes, I'm so smart. The other one, well, don't have the answer, confirms their belief that they're a failure or that they're stupid. When they do get the answer, it was luck. It's not me, it's because I was lucky, it was an easy question, or anyone can answer that. We do that all the time. You solve a problem, do you feel as if it was because it was an easy problem to solve or because you're smart? And again, your own self-beliefs will feed this and feed how you react to them. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in the second part. I do want to say something about perfectionism. Nothing could be completely mastered, whether it's health, knowledge, image, whatever. And ultimately, you have to be able to tolerate a degree of imperfection or uncertainty. Otherwise, everything becomes threatening. So people who want to make sure that nothing bad happens are always under a lot of stress, because no matter how prepared you are to face life, you have to also be able to accept that sometimes things are not going to work out. We'll talk about that in a second. So individuals who think in absolutes, black and white, suffer most from anxiety and depression, and I throw in anger as well. In other words, you need the ability to let go, to control what you can, but accept what you can't. And the ones who are much more absolute in the way they see things really struggle with stress, with anxiety, with depression, with conflicts, and so on. So ultimately, you need to control your sense of control. If you want to prevent bad things from happening, if I want to prevent bad things from happening, I must know what they are and how to handle them. Right? I'd love to know what can happen to me physically so that I can respond to them and prevent them. So, if I can control myself, everyone around me, and all the circumstances, then everything will be fine. You know, make sure that everyone does their job, make sure that everyone does it well, make sure that, you know, people don't slack off, and so on and so forth. Everything will be smooth. If not, then I'm screwed. And the bottom line is that we don't have complete control. And the more absolute thinkers, the more you want to make sure that nothing bad happens, the more you then struggle to, okay, I got to make sure that I can do all of these things. I got to make sure that other people do their job. I got to make sure that nothing unforeseen happens. And that's why novelty, unpredictability, and so on traps us. Because ultimately, you have to be able to accept that you cannot control everything. The more you want to, the more you are going to be stressed. An awful lot of people here are putting on coats, so I'm assuming it's pretty cold in here. I don't know if we can do anything about it, if we can control that. I guess not. Okay, one more slide and then we'll take our break for those of you who need to. I think it's one more slide, one or two anyway. All right, I want to talk about managing doubt. I call it the Batman's belt story, okay? Managing doubt, again, if we think about human beings as they evolved in a natural environment, the caveman, the cavewoman, And you think about, okay, well, okay, we'll take a modern cave person, we'll take Batman, because he, the image I have, that the belt is, it seemed that no matter what happened to this guy, whether it was the Joker or the Penguin or the Riddler or anyone else, he always had something in his belt. He had a little poof to make the, you know, smoke bomb so he can disappear. He always had the, you know, he can throw his line across and climb up a building. And man, he had hundreds of feet of cord in that little belt of his. Remarkable. So he had everything he needed. He must have anticipated all the things that can go wrong in life that the, you know, nefarious foes would dream up. And he had a tool to counter that. And think about that as a stress response, right? We think about what can go wrong, and then we want to put in place a tool to prevent it. So, if you walk into a forest, it's a new forest, you don't know what's out there, you start thinking, okay, what can happen? So what can happen in a forest? What are the dangers? Well, you start thinking, okay, let me think, what if I run into a bear? Okay, I'm going to bring a rifle. All right, I got my rifle. So in case I run into a bear, I'm calm, I'm cool. Put that on my belt. What else can happen? Run into a snake. Better wear thick boots. I'll bring a knife. If it's a constrictor, I'll have to cut it off before it chokes me and so on and so forth. Okay, so I got my knife, I got my gun. What else can happen? Well, you can get lost. Okay, I'll bring a compass. Or maybe just a bunch of popcorn and, you know, make a trip, something. You got to come up with a tool, right? Okay, I got the idea. I'm prepared. If I see a bear, I have my gun. I see a knife, I have my snake, I have my knife. I get lost, I have my popcorn to follow. I'm all set. Oh, wait, I might get thirsty. I better drink some water. Oh, wait, I better bring water. And what if a spider lands on me? I'll wear a hat. I'll wear thick jeans, denim, so I won't get bit by a spider. In other words, we start thinking of all the things that go wrong. You bring a tool to prepare yourself, right? So I can control each worrisome stressor as long as I know what it is and I have a tool to overcome it. And in this analogy of the forest, when you have a new challenge, either a new project to work on, or you're embarking on new studies, or you're working in a new department, you start thinking, why are you stressed? You're stressed because all kinds of stuff can happen. You start thinking, what can happen? Well, okay, I'll make sure I have this, I'll make sure I have that. I used to go to exams. When I was in CJEP, it was so easy. I figured, okay, here's my theory for doing well at CJEP. You have a good breakfast, you sleep well, have a good breakfast, and bring a pen. And maybe bring two pens. Just think, okay, so I brought two pens. Then I get to university, and I go, yikes. I forgot to factor in the study part. Okay, you know what? Here's a new plan. Screw the sleep, study all night long, grab a chocolate bar in the metro on the way in, and bring three or four pens because the first two are going to dry out. Okay. So, bottom line is that we need to anticipate what can go wrong so we can prepare for it. That's the stress response. Whatever happens to be your challenge, you think about the things that can happen to you, you prepare, you feel less stressed. So, responsibilities and mastery over the responsibilities reduces your stress, right? So we have a tendency to think of all the things that can go wrong. And the one who doesn't think is more vulnerable. The one who goes into a new challenge without preparing is more vulnerable. But then at the other end are the people who want to predict everything. The control freaks. The ones who want to know what can happen. Well, we do this, we do that, they prepare. These are the people who burn out all the time because they keep thinking of what else can go wrong. Think about driving. If you don't worry at all, you put yourself at risk. But, you know, say, okay, make sure my tires are good, make sure my brakes are good, make sure this, it's raining, I'll slow down a little bit, it's snowing, I'll slow down a little more, and so I'll respect speed limits, more or less. And we do all those kinds of things to reduce risk. But there's no guarantee that you won't have an accident, right? So how do we handle the remaining doubt? You can't drive without accepting the possibility that something bad will happen. You can eat well, exercise, follow medical advice, but there's no guarantee that something bad won't happen. The building could collapse. There could be an earthquake in the next 5 minutes. You know, what do we do? I'll stand over there in the corner. bottom line is that we can't guarantee everything. So by anticipating and preparing, you reduce risk to a reasonable level. But there are people who want to reduce it to zero. And those are the people who spend all kinds of time thinking, what can happen, what can happen, what can happen? And they're spending all kinds of effort to overcome it and prepare and do and rewrite the sentence and whatever it is and recheck the code. All of this stuff because they're trying to get rid of the doubt. And you can't. So ultimately, how do you face an unknown? How do you face an unknown forest? You need two ultimate tools. Okay? So let me think of what can go wrong, and I'll prepare myself as much as I can for all of those major risks. But there's a little bit of uncertainty. And I can't think of everything that can happen. A tree could fall on me, you know, whatever. There could be more than one bear. There could be a lion. I run out of bullets, and so on and so forth. So at some point, you have to say, well, you know what? I'll figure it out when I'm there. So the second last tool is confidence in your ability to deal with the unforeseen. If I have abilities, then whatever happens, I'll probably manage. So if there's an earthquake, well, you know what, we'll have to see. You know, can anyone speak? Can anyone move? Can you reach your phone? And so on and so forth. You'll do what you have to do to survive, right? So you cannot face uncertainty without the confidence in your ability to overcome unforeseen circumstances. Very simple, but it's an important thing. Because people without that confidence keep wanting to obsess over what can happen. And then the ultimate tool is, remember I said, whatever happens, you will probably be able to manage around it. There's no guarantee. So you need to also be able to accept that sometimes bad things are going to happen. Sometimes you lose your job. Sometimes there's going to be a health emergency that you can't overcome. And sometimes there will be serious accidents and so on. But you cannot face life without accepting that possibility. Okay, it is 10:20. Figured we'll have a little break here. And some of you need to go smoke, and others you need to empty your bladders. Or I'm not sure if there's 10 minutes is fine. We'll have plenty of time. Okay, and we'll have questions at the end for both parts. So feel free. ouais, non, non, c'est bien, c'est bien. Non, ça aide beaucoup parce que... Well, welcome back. This next part is going to be on adapting to change, building self-confidence, and getting along. But before I do that, there's a couple of slides from my earlier presentation that I cut out of concern for time, because I tend to tell stories and I never stop until time's up. But there are a couple of stories I think are important, and I think we're going to have time for it. So. One is about the sure no problem guy, because there's always a sure no problem guy, the one that always says yes to everything. Can you drive me here? Sure, no problem. Can you do this for tomorrow? Sure, no problem. Can you train this guy? Sure, no problem. Until one day he's in a shower in the morning and crying, and one guy said to me, "Well, was he, you know, on the floor in the fetal position?" I said, no, okay, so I guess he wasn't totally burnt out yet. But the guy was burnt out plenty. And the problem is that you say to someone, you know, he just has to learn to say no. And it's easy to say to someone, just say no, but how do you do that? And I don't think someone who has the character that wants to please people can just start saying, no, you figure it out for yourself. But he did say, how about if you can insert a delay mechanism? How about if you could say something, if someone, you worked in a bank, right? So someone would always ask him, a new guy, can you show me how to do the mortgage? And yeah, I'll do that. Meanwhile, he's got his own stuff to do and he's feeling, you know, stressed and so on. So I said to him, how about if you say things like, well, look, I'm in the middle of something, I'll help you in a little bit. Or if at the end of the day I have some time, I'll come help you. So it's easier to do that than to say no. And then at the end of the day, either the guy has figured it out on his own or gone somewhere else, or you might come back and help him, or you might come back and say, listen, I want to help, but I got caught up in what I was doing, I didn't have time. It gives the guy the message that, listen, I'd love to help, but I can't always do it automatically. So it's to break that habit of saying yes all the time. Does not necessarily require saying no. It can be done by just starting to say, okay, let me think about it before you give an answer, before you raise your hand, before you volunteer. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is, there's a go-to guy in every department, isn't there? And you know what? Let's take these two nice ladies here. Let's suppose that you, well, sorry to say this, but one of you really works well, and one of you doesn't. You know, the person who does everything well, does it on time, does it efficiently, no mistakes. The other one who, you know, is going to complain and is over, says she's overworked, and you know that her work is full of mistakes, and you know. So let's suppose that you're the manager, okay? Let's pretend. And you've been burnt out in the past, so you know what it's like, and she's been burnt out in the past, and she's begging you, please, you know, I've got too much work to do, and you know it, you understand it, she knows it, and you've got a really important project. And you got a deadline, and you have a couple of days to do it. And you got to sign it to one of your employees. And if you give it to her, you know you're going to get it on time. It's going to be impeccable. It's going to be a beautiful job. Give it to the other one. She's going to say, I have too much work to do, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be done. It's not going to be done. It's going to be given late. You're going to look at it. You're going to have to redo half the work. It's going to be a lot of crap. Who do you ask?
The first one.
But she's begging you, I have too much stuff to do. And you know that she's cracking. She does three times the work of the other one. Well, the problem is that happens a lot, right? It happens a lot in departments. You have a tendency to always go towards the one who's going to do it well. No, apologize. You could both be go-to people, you know? But you have to protect yourselves. You have to protect your good employees by respecting them and so on. You can't leave it to the last minute to deal with a problem like that. And if you're going to use a person for emergencies, then don't use her for everything else. This kind of stuff. You have to learn to spread it out. That's a difficult challenge, especially given the fact that it's very hard to deal with difficult employees and so on. But not just the managers, but also your colleagues, right? You need advice, you go see the person who has an answer for everything. And, give them some space, okay? Otherwise, you'll end up losing them. Okay, now we're going to talk about change, overcoming resistance to change. I originally was going to talk about Rolodexes. I was going to call the talk, I missed my Rolodex, and then I was told, well, you know, these people didn't have Rolodexes, they replaced the people who had the Rolodexes. I said, that's right. The fact is that, as I said, I typed my master's thesis on a manual typewriter. And you know, I did my doctoral thesis with all these index cards where I wrote down all the references. That's what I used, you know. And so, you know, the computer generation, you know, it's this wave that's coming. And you guys were the change. This is the result of that computer revolution. So I kind of found it ironic that even in this industry, a lot of people are resistant to change. Okay? So your changes, you represented change in the previous generation, you're going to have to deal with your own level of change to a certain extent, right? But were you really that threatening? Aren't things actually better today? Certainly if you want information, you can get it anywhere you want, you can communicate easily. If your daughter's somewhere, you can text her and make sure she's okay. You know, there are drawbacks to living in this virtual community, this worldwide community, but there's also a lot of advantages, and I think very few of us would want to go back to using the typewriter and having a smoke-filled room and so on. I had some people, I was fed up at some point. I'm actually not chief of psychology anymore. I used to be for many years, but I was there for a lot of the transition to computerizations and email and so on and so forth. And we used to, every time there was a meeting, we'd have to type out a little invitation to the meeting and stuff 50 envelopes, interdepartmental envelopes, and send them out. And then I started sending emails with the invitation. And for a while I had to send emails and the envelopes. To a certain point where I said, I can't do this anymore. I told people, if you don't have email, get email. And I always had 5 or 10 psychologists. They're just as hard-headed as any other professional. And I prefer getting it by paper. I said, I don't care what you prefer. I prefer not to do work twice. Okay? No, I wasn't that direct. But the bottom line is, I said to them, here's the deal. You get email. If after 2 months you don't like email, we'll undo it and I'll send you paper copies. And no one came back after 2 months. Because I didn't know anyone who, after using email, said, I wish I didn't have email. Do you know anyone? So, anyway. We have a tendency to think that change is not going to be good, but okay, go back to the old stuff and see if you prefer that. Why is change scary? Well, familiar is comfortable, right? We have the tools. We have control. We know what's what. If we're in the same forest as owls, we know what's out there. You know, we're not going to get lost. And any change doesn't come with a guarantee of success. You don't know for sure if you're going to be able to manage the new circumstances. So, of course, unforeseen challenges require unforeseen skills, and we don't know for sure that we're going to have it. So, once again, the person who wants to have control is going to be more stressed by change. So, let's go back to the formula, the little acronym for stressful: novelty, unpredictability, something that is threatening to you in some way, and when you don't have the sense of control that you'd like. So, why is change so stressful? Well, because, as I said, you don't know. Any change is unknown, right? We don't know where it's going to lead, where this road will lead. And of course, if we don't manage, we might lose our jobs, get negative evaluations, and so on and so forth. And if we lose our jobs, we'll lose our income, we might lose our house, and so on. And of course, if you don't know what's there, you don't know if you have any control over it. So change is stressful. So how do you overcome resistance to change? It's a big challenge. It's a challenge for any department, especially not so much here as much as anywhere else, but you know, in any large department, especially when we're dealing with new systems, when we're dealing with cutbacks and efficiency. It was easy to manage in the 60s when everything was growing and budgets were doubling. Remember, someone wanted to create a department, went to see his brother-in-law at another in professional services and said, listen, I'd like to set up a department of such and such form of therapy. I'm going to need 3 nurses and 2 psychologists and a doctor and blah, blah, blah. And okay, boom, you got the money by talking to the guy for 5 minutes. Could you imagine? We want to create one position. We have meetings with 30 people for 20 years, it seems. Okay, I'm exaggerating, 19 years. 18, and if people are working efficiently. So unfortunately, resistance to change is much harder when we are dealing with trying to do more with less, because it forces us to use the resources we have rather than, you know, develop new resources and so on. And that means sometimes saying these 3 people are going to be asked to do this job because, you know, we have a new system that could make that run more efficiently and give it to just this guy, this kind of stuff, right? Well, if you're one of those 3 guys, you have to deal with, well, I haven't done that before and I like what I'm doing and so on and so forth. So overcoming resistance is a difficult thing. But changes that are understood are always easier and less resisted than ones that are not explained. And this is an important factor, because a lot of people will sort of do all the plans and the preparing and then say, okay, here's what we're going to do. I, as a professional, I had to deal with 2 major changes in the healthcare system, as you know, where I was cutting and so on and so forth. And we went from 1 major set of cuts to another major set of cuts, and required us to reorganize mental health services. The first time, they abolished departments. So there's no more psychology department. And essentially what it meant was that the psychologist worked for anxiety disorders, depression, schizophrenia, and so on and so forth, and didn't work for the chief of psychology. So I come in as the advisor in professional services, but not as anyone's actual boss. So there's a lot of resistance to losing a manager, losing a department, and so on and so forth. And people didn't quite understand it, because it was 6 of 1, 6 of the other. I came from a program management model to a departmental model and vice and back and forth. And they both work and they both also have their problems. But then, in the late, in the late 2010s, there was another major change where we emptied a lot of the psychiatric hospitals and transferred the staff to CLSCs, Why, in order to have mental health teams available to the community, rather than having to, you know, go to your GP, refer you to a psychiatric institute, and wait in line to see a psychiatrist who maybe is going to give you referral to some therapist, you can go straight to the CLSC and get your services. And when people were talking about, oh, they're going to close our positions, they're going to move us, I would always talk about when your mom or when your dad or when your brother or sister want to get help, where do they go? And when you explain that to them and say, listen, it's important for people to have access immediately without having to go through the complex medical system, everyone said, yeah, that makes sense. And very few people resisted that change. Again, the more you explain, the more you understand the reason for it. If it's a logical change, don't be afraid of explaining it. And when you explain changes to people, it's going to be much more accepted and less resisted. So obviously, it all depends on trust, a relationship of trust. If someone is analyzing something and they're stuck with, okay, I've got this much money, I've got to do something, and scratching their heads, and I think this is going to work, and you trust that they're doing their best given the circumstances, and you trust that the employees are going to do their best as well, then it's not so hard to deal with change because we're in this together. I have dealt with all kinds of managers. In fact, in my own position, I was not a real manager, but I was a manager. I was the chief of psychology, but nobody worked for me. So the psychologists would come to me and talk about their managers, and the managers would come to me and talk to me about their psychologists. And I got it from both ends. And it was amazing to see that most of the time was because people misinterpreted or mistrusted what the other person's motives were. And one person, for example, would, you know, propose things at meetings, and then at the end of the meetings would gather all the documents because she didn't want any rumors to get out of the room. And all the staff would say, you know, we're just waiting to see what's going to happen, you know, and they're all sitting there waiting for the shoe to drop, and there's rumors, but nobody knows anything, and then boom, they're met and we're told, you're going here, we're closing this department on this date, and here's the plan, and so on. So the woman in her had intended to avoid arguments, rumors, all kinds of stuff, but in so doing created an atmosphere of distrust. And the reality is, if we said, listen, you know, the government is asking us to do this, we think it's better for the people to live in foster homes rather than on a ward and line up for food and enemas and cigarettes and whatever else they do, and shower time, have a more living, natural environment, people would have said, yeah, that makes sense. So I think you need to explain change. The more you explain change and the reason for it, if you assume that people aren't dumb and everyone is in it together to make things better for everyone, then change is going to be less resistant. So that's why transparency is so essential. The more you explain, the less things are resisted. Otherwise, lack of information has a tendency to create an atmosphere of mistrust. So, if you want transparency, you must remain open to new ideas. And here's the problem, right? What this lady was doing is she was resisting telling people anything, because if she did, then people start questioning why you're doing this, and so on and so forth. They try to interfere. In other words, unless you're open to actually consider information, and let's look at that possibility, let's see if it makes any sense. If you're going to be resistant to that, people just won't talk to you. I say this all the time. There are two people responsible for a lie, whether it's commission or omission. Two people. The person lying and the person being lied to. Now, that's not always fair to the person who is being lied to, if you're the parent and your kids are lying to you. But the fact is that the more you are going to be difficult, the more you're going to be closed to new ideas, the more you're going to argue back, the more you're going to encourage someone to tell you lies or to leave out details. So you're not completely independent of this. Okay? An openness, an open-mindedness, a fairness, a giving a person the benefit of the doubt is required by both sides in order to get transparency. So let's talk about self-confidence. How did I get here? Well, let's think about overcoming stress. When you have something new to face, you're stressed because you have a new change. Why? Well, because it's novel, it's unpredictable, it's threatening, and there's no control. So to overcome the stress, to overcome the change, is to really develop some self-confidence in what you've done in the past. Okay? So is it really completely novel? A new circumstance, is it as different as you think? Are there similarities to past changes? And if you have managed similar things in the past, even if it's a new project, if you had the skills in the past, then it's not so new. So it should be less stressful. Is it so unpredictable? Have you seen a pattern in the past that things turn out okay in the end? Again, past changes, management of past changes, most people manage them well in time. So you shouldn't be as worried about future changes if you can look back at successes over past changes. Is it threatening to the self? Are the consequences of a slow learning curve so threatening? Because sometimes changes do require quite a while, and as a result, can be much more stressful because, you know, well, I'm not going to keep up with everyone else, I'm going to lose my job, I'm going to get negative feedback, and so on and so forth. But the truth is that if you assume that we're all in the same boat together, again, the idea of the imposter syndrome, if you are having trouble learning, chances are pretty good that everyone around you is also going through the same struggles. And if everyone is struggling, then it's not you that's going to be threatened. We're all in the same boat together. And, you know, is there really no sense of control? The fact is, if you are struggling, if you have a good relationship with your colleagues, they can help you along. Good relationship with your managers, they can help you along, and so forth. We all have mentors. So you can take the stress formula, the novelty, the unpredictability, the threats, and the sense of control. If you're feeling stressed by a change, you can go back and look at those things. Okay, what's threatening to me? Is it because it's new? If it's new, can someone help me? Or is there something I can transfer from past experiences? Is it as unpredictable as you think? And chances are most of these things have a pattern that are not that difficult to predict. You know, how bad would it be if you're struggling? Would you be singled out? Most of the time you wouldn't, and so forth. And do you have more control than you think you do? The perfectionist wants to have perfect control. But the truth is that most of us have all the control we need. Not as much as we want, but all that we need. Okay, so how do we build self-confidence? How many of you know people around you who are quite competent but don't really have a lot of self-confidence? You know people, don't you? You know some pretty good people who don't have a lot of confidence, but they're pretty smart. How many of you know people who have a lot of self-confidence and don't really have a lot of competence? Have you, you know one or two of those? Don't look to your right or left at this point. So the truth is that when we look around us, we often see that confidence and competence are pretty uncorrelated, right? It's as if confidence has very little to do with real abilities in many cases. And competence doesn't seem to always come with confidence. And you see it all around. Everywhere you look, you see people who lack confidence. You see people who have way too much confidence. Even in high school, it's the ugly guys who had the girls. How did that work? Well, because they just had confidence in themselves. All right. I guess that's a hint. I don't know. Never worked for me, anyway. So I say this because when you look in the mirror, you see a person who is confident or not. You see a person who is competent or not. But really what you see, you think is a reality. If you see a competent person in the mirror, you think you are actually competent. And if you think you see an incompetent person in the mirror, you think you are incompetent. The truth is that it doesn't necessarily match with the rest of the world, why would it match necessarily in your case? So there's an awful lot of people who don't have confidence and have really all the ability they need. So just remember, when you see other people who don't have confidence, they don't necessarily lack the skills. They often are worthy, useful, productive employees. And maybe you are too. Just something to consider. Here's another story. Imagine that you're colorblind. If you're colorblind, and let's suppose that you're going to win a major award, or a loved one, or is going to have an award, Nobel Prize, whatever it is, Employee of the Year, and you're going to be honored at this soiree. And you open up your cupboard door, you open up your closet door, or cupboard if you want, you can have a soup before you go, but open up your closet door, and you see all of these shades of colors that look nice to you, but you know they don't make any sense. And you don't want to look like a complete idiot. What do you do? You either wear black or you ask someone. Well, this is purple, so it doesn't count. It's dark. But you ask someone, right? Very simple. You recognize that, look, I can't judge color properly. My vision is distorted. So I'm going to ask other people for their opinion. And I'm going to trust their opinion. Okay? Very simple. Recognize that you cannot judge properly. Look for outside information. Now, instead of colorblind, let's imagine you're a perfectionist. And nothing you do is good enough. So you write a paper, let's say you're in school, you write a paper, you spend 10 hours on it, and most people spend 8 hours, and you've already spent 10 hours, and you're looking at it, and you're fixing it, and you're fixing it, and you're fixing it, and you're fixing it, and you're asking yourself, is it good enough? What you're doing is, if you're a perfectionist, it's never going to be good enough, right? So it's like looking in the closet trying to figure something out when you can't see properly. You have a distorted vision. A perfectionist cannot judge their own work accurately because it's never good enough. So what should a person like that do? A person like that should at some point say, wait a second here. Let me ask others. If the teacher gives me a good grade, if I just stop after 10 hours and I don't feel it's good enough, well, I don't know that. Maybe it isn't, maybe it is. I'm going to have to wait and see what the professor says or what other people say. And if I have just as good grades as everyone else and they spent 8 hours, chances are if I spend 10 hours. So as much as possible when we're dealing with these issues clinically, we try and get people to look for objective data, objective information. But it starts with recognizing that you cannot judge yourself. Because if you're looking at your own standards, you're always looking at these crazy colors. They're never going to make sense to you. It's never going to be good enough. So you have to recognize that I cannot be the one judging. I have to let someone else tell me. And I'm going to have to trust their opinion. Okay. Let's take this other story. Let's suppose you get a math problem. And you look at this and you have no idea how to answer it. And you're totally lost. And after about 10 minutes, ding, something comes to you. Okay, you figure it out. You get another math problem. Again, you have no idea. And you don't think you'll manage. And then after a few minutes, you start thinking about it. Oh yeah, and you come up with a solution. So you do this 5 times. 5 times you have a problem that is beyond you. You take the time to think, and at some point, a solution comes. Now I give you number 6. I give you number 6, and you look at it, and you have no idea how to answer it. How do you react to that? Well, it'll depend on what you learned in the first 5. There's some people who say, you know what? I have the ability to solve problems. In other words, past successes mean this is probably something I'll be able to figure out also, so is not so stressed by the fact that number 6 is unknown at the beginning. But then there's a lot of people who say, well, I had the ability to solve those problems. That problem, that one, that one, that one, that one, but not necessarily this one. And that's an important distinction. Do you learn that you have the ability to solve a math problem or the math problem? And so sometimes people from past successes trust their skills and therefore are not so scared of change. And others say, well, I knew that, I knew that, I knew that, but this is totally different, so I have no proof that I know this. Well, of course you don't have proof. All you have is your ability to overcome challenges. So what you learn from the first challenges that you overcame will say a lot about how you manage the change in the future. Let's suppose that I ask you, do you have a good job? Yes, I have a good job. Do you have friends? Yes, I have friends. I have a family, blah, blah, blah. I say, okay, I'm going to take you out of this world. I'm going to transport you into a parallel universe on another planet where everything looks the same, but you don't have a job and you don't know anyone. So you're totally on your own. How would you react to that change? It's quite a challenge, right? So you had a job and you had friends in your old world. What would happen after a year if I ran into you in a year? Would you be working? Would you have friends? Chances are, if you were able to work before, you're going to find work again. Chances are, if you had friends before, you're going to have friends again. Why do I come up with this crazy example? Because the truth is that when you go to a new circumstance, a new planet, a new company, a new city, you bring with you all the tools that helped you before. So friendship comes from two ingredients, you and being around people. And you and people interact and boom, you make a connection and another connection and so on and so forth. So why would you think that in a new circumstance, you don't have everything you need? You bring with you the tools that got you to where you are. In the past, you bring it with you to any new circumstances. So, ultimately, confidence is a two-step process. You know, when I was a kid, I used to love tennis. Now I like golf. Wasn't very good at either of them, but I've only been practicing golf for 30 years. I figured another 30, I'll probably start to perfect it. But the bottom line is the first time I played tennis, what do you think I did? I spent my day chasing the ball over the fence. Not a lot of fun. But I was interested, you know, I was watching Bjorn Borg and so on, so I was interested enough to say, I'd like to try that. And I'd see other people, I'd like to try that. So I needed a little bit of curiosity and interest to embark on something. But then it was the fact that every once in a while the ball stayed in the court. Every once in a while I hit a good shot. That made me say, oh, I like that, I want to do it again. And then the more you do it, the more you enjoy it, and the more you're rewarded, and so you become a tennis fan after success. So you don't become a fan at the beginning. You're interested enough to try something, and then you succeed, and then you start liking it. Same thing with golf. First time you're chasing the ball in the forest and the lake and so on and so forth. And, well, I'm still doing that, but not as often. Every once in a while you hit a really sweet shot and it feels good, it makes you go back. So the same way interest develops over time, so does confidence. A new challenge, you're not going to have confidence in a new challenge right away. Looking at your past, looking at what you've done before, says, okay, you know, I was able to do it before, I'll probably be able to do it again. It's enough to have confidence to try something, but it is in the success of doing it that really builds a self-confidence. So don't expect to have a lot of self-confidence at the beginning. I have a woman very depressed, freaking out because, you know, her company was bought out. It had to go, had to make a decision, either same company, different tasks, or same task, different company. And she's freaking out because she doesn't feel like she belongs, and she is really freaking out. Except that in the job that she left, and they partied for her, they missed her, she was so appreciated and loved where she was before, For 5 years, she felt like she didn't belong there. Eventually developed confidence, and now she's in a new circumstance and doesn't think that she can do it. Well, you can't expect confidence to be there right away. Again, two steps. Enough, learn from the past to have confidence that you can handle it or you can try it. And then give yourself the time it takes to really develop that sense of confidence. Okay, now we're going to talk about relationships and just general circumstances that I believe affect interpersonal relations. Kind of related to what we've talked about, but not totally. Here are some factors. Tendency to obsess, to be rigid. Major issue. Unrelenting standards or extreme standards. Mistrust. And groupthink. And these, to me, are... Now we're kind of changing the chapter, the story a little bit. We're going to talk about getting along. And in, both personally and intra and interpersonally. And I think these are some of the psychological factors that I think contribute to a lot of personal problems, a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, and so on, and also lead to a lot of problems in groups and in relationships between different departments. Okay, so let's start with talking about obsessiveness. The one who wants to get everything exactly right. And we all have different degrees of this tendency. As I said, I want that in the person building the next Champlain Bridge. But you know the sense that there's a right way to do things. And the more you feel there's a right way to do things, the more you get upset when people aren't doing it right. And you see this a lot in engineering and those kinds of worlds like IT and so on. Because, you know, a program either works or it doesn't work. There really is very little in between, right? And so there is the fact that it has to work, and then there's the whole issue of optimization and so on and so forth. But this personality trait tends to be rigid and controlling. It leads to a focus on specific details, often to the detriment of the larger goal. You know, if you say, for example, we shouldn't waste taxpayers' dollars, we all agree. Well, if there's a manager who has a budget of $4 million, and is in deficit of, you know, $400,000, and is looking at the long-distance charges. And on December 7th, 1997, at 4:32 p.m., you made a long-distance call that was unauthorized. And they really kind of nail people with these long-distance calls. Meanwhile, there's a $400,000 deficit that they're not paying attention to because they're focused on this detail. You know, those people are not going to be able to manage things well. So some people tend to be overly focused on details. The more you're focused on details, the more you're going to have trouble. Or the more you believe that something is right, the more you're going to have conflict with people who see it differently. So inevitably, it leads to conflict. Even if everyone around you, and here's important, if others do 95% of things exactly as you would, we agree on 95% of things, the remaining 5% becomes a source of conflict in the absence of compromise and flexibility. So how right does it have to be? And the people who are 100%, this is how it should be, unless you find someone who's going to agree with you 100% of the time, it's going to cause conflict. Again, people lose focus on the bigger picture by focusing on the details. Unfortunately, nothing's going to be quite right, but nevertheless, it's going to be pretty good. 95% is a good grade. It's not 100, but it's a damn good grade, and that's as good as it's going to get. Okay. Rigidity is the other thing. Because with obsessiveness is a tendency to feel as if this is the right way and you're going to be less flexible, and trust me, when there's no flexibility, you're going to be miserable and you're going to create misery for everyone around you. So two guys share an apartment, and one of them feels the toilet paper should come under from underneath. And the other, for some God unforsaken reason, feels as if it should come from the top. And one guy goes to the bathroom and goes, "God damn it," and turns it back. And the other guy goes, "Like, what the fuck?" And turns it back the other way, this way. And they keep doing this war of toilet papers until finally it ends up in a pool of blood. And neighbors are being interviewed. And what the hell happened? I don't know. Yeah. I think it was about toilet paper. Another bathroom rage incident. But you know, if you live with anyone, if you live with kids, if you live with a spouse, there's all kinds of things that you wouldn't do your way. Where you're going to put the TV and how big your speakers need to be or not, and so on and so forth. And so if my wife ever leaves me, I'm going to take my big speakers from downstairs and I'm going to put them where they belong. But the bottom line is that without the ability to compromise, and you know, if you think about just two people living in an apartment, yeah, they're there all the time, so it's much tougher, but you know, you were with your colleagues for 40 hours a week. And not only one, you're with several colleagues for 40 hours a week. And some people are going to play music, and some are going to bring their coffee to their desk, and some are going to sort of hum out loud, and you're going to want to shoot them sometimes because they're humming, and so on and so forth. The fact is, you have to be able to tolerate that things aren't going to be exactly the way you want. The more rigid you are, the more conflict you're going to have. Then another issue that causes conflict is standards. What are the appropriate standards? What's the right amount of concern for efficiency and, you know, lateness? How much do we tolerate? Do we tolerate 5 minutes? Do we tolerate half an hour? Do we not tolerate anything? Do we start meetings on time? You know, you go to some departments, they always start their meetings 20 minutes late. You know, I used to deliberately say, okay, meetings at 10:30, it would take me 10 minutes to walk over, so I'll leave at 10:45 because I know I'll still be the first one there. Okay? And that's not right when you start doing those kinds of things. So we all have standards, and the question is, what is an appropriate standard? And the more you have high standards, the more you're going to have people who are not at that level. Your standards are too low, it causes problems. Someone once said to me, what's the secret, the three-word secret to happiness? Lower your standards. So, well, that's true. However, there are people who have standards that are too low, and they don't worry about anything. They don't worry about money until one day they're bankrupt, or they get a bill in the mail. Someone I know just had a $10,000 tax bill because they didn't pay installments and they have rental income and so on and so forth. And they know they need to do this, they just don't bother caring. Same thing with health. If you don't have standards, one day you'll end up saying, oh my God, I guess I should pay attention to my cholesterol or my blood pressure or whatever. So low standards are not good, but so are high standards. Let me tell you the story of the chicken skins. I like to tell stories. Let's suppose that you have to go see a doctor for a cardiac bypass surgery. Ooh, I need to accelerate things. Cardiac bypass surgery. You have two doctors to choose from. Doctor number one, I call Dr. Chicken Skins, because what he does every day is he practices on the skin of chicken breasts. He cuts the skin because the consistency of chicken skin is similar to veins. And he practices his surgical technique every day. And he makes sure that the stitches are equidistant from each other. And the distance between the stitch and the cut is precise. And the tension is just right. Too tight, the person could bleed. You could tear the vein. Too loose, and the person could bleed from the cut. So it has to be just right. So you got this guy who practices day in, day out on chicken skins as a potential doctor for your heart bypass surgery. Then you got Dr. B, who says, good enough. Okay, so which one would you go to? You go to the first doctor. Now, who would you rather live with? And same thing goes with work, right? You know, you want people who have high standards, but too high, and then it becomes impossible to please, and everything is a war, and so on and so forth. So questioning your standards is important. We have a tendency to, I think a lot of conflicts come from people who have standards that are too high, or managers that have too high expectations, or the person themselves. But too low also causes problems. Here's another story. You have two salespeople, each sold for $1 million in the previous year. They both set a goal the next year of $2 million. Ambitious. They both managed to sell $1.5 million in the next year. How do they feel? Well, one guy could say, yes, 50% improvement. He set the goal as, you know what, aim high and you'll get better. That's all. He doesn't expect to get there. To him, it's a direction. And he's proud of the 50% improvement. The other guy sets it as a goal, as a minimum goal. And he lives that as a failure. They both have the same successes, the same numbers. They both have the same objective. But how you see the objective has everything to do with it. If you feel as if that's the standard, that's the minimum, anything short of that is going to be failure. If you see it as a direction towards improvement, you're going to see the success. So again, the whole issue of standards is something you need to look at within yourselves and within your department. You've heard this expression? You want it done right, do it yourself. God damn it. All right? The truth is, if you want it done your way, do it yourself. So the first question is it, make sure it is the right way, first of all, and the only right way. Usually there's a lot of ways to do something, and to do it well. So, essentially, here's my advice. If you want the important things done right, then do only the important things yourself. Otherwise, again, you're going to end up being the go-to person, or the control person, or, you know what, I'll sit back and let you do the dishes because you do them better than I do. Right? My father was like that when we were younger, whenever we knew that when he would show us how to do something, he would take over and finish the job. So we're doing the dishes, and can you show me how to do the dishes? And he'd come and he'd finish the dishes. Didn't take long for us kids to learn that part. Okay, mistrust, big issue here. You know, a lot of people feel as if they can be taken advantage of. And when you trust people, you can get burned. Well, it's true. If you trust blindly 100%, you can be taken advantage of. But the other side, if you don't trust, you will never, never be happy. And no relationship will ever work in the absence of trust. Now, I'm not saying you have to trust blindly, but again, you have to trust enough. Because otherwise, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. People who don't trust spouses will always question, where were you? And where were you? Well, I was out with some friends. Oh, yeah? Was that floozy with you? Was Kathy with you? You guys went out? Well, yeah, it's just a friend. Oh, yeah? Oh, yeah? Okay. So next time they ask you out, you're going to say no, or you're going to say yes because you feel bad, but then after you're going to go home and tell your wife that, oh, yeah, I was out, I was working late. And then she's going to say, oh, yeah? Well, I called, and you weren't there, and they said you went out, and Kathy was with you guys. So at some point when you're not trusted, when you don't trust, you create a situation where people actually will lie to you. So what I mean by that is it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. When you don't trust someone's motives, okay? Unjustified mistrust. If you don't trust someone that you should be trusting, will lead to justified mistrust. Let me explain that. It leads to a pattern of behavior that it will inevitably lead to conflict and further mistrust. Here's an example. Let's suppose I lend someone my book. They take my book, and a week later, it's not there. They haven't brought it back. And I go see them and I say, listen, do you have my book? And, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. And I say, were you intending to keep this book? If I don't trust the person, I might say something like that. Imagine if I say something like that. How does the other person react? What the hell is this guy's problem? Then maybe one day I'm asking them, listen, are you guys going out for lunch? And I might get an answer, no, I'm going to work at my desk, and so on. And then later in the afternoon, I overhear them talking about the restaurant they went to at lunch, and I say, oh, I thought you guys were working at lunch. Aha! I knew I couldn't trust you. So when you don't trust, then people start hiding things from you. People start, you know, lying to avoid an argument, and eventually you're going to catch them in one of those lies. So mistrust is self-fulfilling, and it ruins all relationships, whether it's with a spouse or whether it's with a colleague or so on. So transparency is always the best policy. Decisions and changes are resisted less when people understand the reasoning behind them, as I mentioned earlier. Occasionally you have to deal with mistrust. One of my secretaries, when I transferred departments, she's at her desk, and she let the answering machine pick up the messages because she wanted to see who was calling first. And occasionally, people would call me directly. Listen, don't mean to bother you with this. I just need something, but I don't want to get the machine. So I said to her, you know, I asked her to answer the phone. Well, you're the boss. This kind of stuff was the answer I got from her. And every once in a while I say, could you call this person and tell him such and such? Well, why does he have to know? And I would sit there and I explained to her, well, because... And I took my time to be transparent. I explained to her, because this and this and this, and we're talking about such and such. Oh, okay. And she did it. So one day I said to her, I said, listen, whenever I explain things to you, you generally agree with me. You generally think it makes sense. Except I don't always have time to explain things to you. So you're going to have to trust me. If you don't trust me, we can't work together. So I had to deal with the mistrust directly. Otherwise, I would have done what other people do, which is just work around her and avoid her and so on and so forth. So you need trust in a relationship to make it work. Okay, I guess I need to accelerate a little bit because it's almost 11:30. I have 4 or 5 slides. No, do I have, how many slides do I have left? Okay, 3 slides. I'm okay. I'll be quick. The last thing I think is important is this tendency to think as groups, right? We all do this. You put 3 people in a room, 2 are going to come up with a group against the third person, the blue-eyed people against the brown-eyed person. Or you put a Canadian sweater on Michael Ryder, he's a good guy. You put a Bruin sweater on Michael Ryder, he's a bad guy, and so on and so forth. Because we have a tendency to think in groups. We all do this, right? Humans have a natural tendency to form groups and seek out strength in numbers. You know, when there's, you know, other villagers are going to come and spear you to death, you need to put on your war paint and protect yourself. So this is a necessary skill in many situations where there is a strong external threat. Wars, oppressive economic conditions, attacks by predators, aliens, zombies, it's all the same thing. You know, the human race is going to unite against Martians or whatever. You'll see this in floods, you see this during major medical epidemics and so on, that we all start thinking as one, and we need that skill. Except that in many circumstances it becomes very dangerous and counterproductive. In fact, it feeds wars, it fuels conflicts, it leads to mistrust, dehumanizing those who don't belong. Well, in the Vietnamese War, it's gooks, or it's Nazis, in the Cambodian Holocaust, it was the new people. Those are people who were kicked out of cities and they were just taking advantage of the laborers and so on. So you created this division in society which allowed people to kill and starve to death all millions of people because of the tendency to think that we are better than others. When Italy won the World Cup, people came up to me and said, congratulations. And I said, why? And then, oh, the World Cup. Oh yeah, okay, I guess. I was born here, but okay, I'll take. And you notice how people are always willing to accept a claim by association, but never guilt by association? And so we have this tendency all the time to talk about we won last night, let's hope we win tonight, this kind of stuff. And that's fine in sports, I guess, but it does tend to mirror what we see in conflicts. And you see this in gender wars, in race wars, in religious wars. You see this also in labor wars. us versus them. Management, what do they know? They don't understand. And I've had clients who, you know, argue that all managers are idiots, or managers who are all union staff are just lazy, and so on and so forth. And it's very hard to convince someone to look at the individual when all they see is the label behind the individual. I was a student. Here I'm a student, you know. And all of a sudden I become a TA, I change chairs, and I'm treated differently. Then I become a professor, and all of a sudden it's, you know, professors, they're all mean, they don't care about your grades, your future, this and that. Then I'm a student, I'm an intern at the clinical setting, and I change chairs, I become the supervisor, and so on. I'm the same guy. I'm the same guy when I was sitting there as I am now. But because the label changes, judgment changes. So the tendency to see people as groups rather than the individual behind the label is a major source of conflict. Let me do this slide. I was going to skip over this one, but this is important. To me, anger is caused by two things: thwarted expectations or perceived injustices. And this is important because it takes communication to understand changes. It takes trust to feel that there is justice. So let's start with thwarted expectations. I bought a car, went to the garage to have a few minor things fixed when it was new, and I needed the car for 4 o'clock because I had an appointment downtown at 5. So I figure I'm going to be smart. I'm going to tell the guy I need it for 3. Okay? Guy says, "Ma met mi zi por 8:10. I'm going to put noon to be sure." I said, "Great. Have it ready for noon. I'll have it ready." So I show up at 4 o'clock to pick up my car. They had just brought it in. I was furious. Why? Because I expected my car to be ready when they said. I was an idiot. These are mechanics. It's a big garage, a big dealer. It's never going to be ready. When I had my kitchen redone, it cost me 3 times as I had budgeted, and took 4 times as long, and I didn't care. Because I knew it was going to take 4 times as long and cost 3 times as much. So I had kind of planned for that. So expectations have a lot to do with it. When someone says, "Do this and," then obviously, or "I'll do this for you, I'll give you a raise next year, you have a promotion," or "this, so you do this project." Well, if you expect something that doesn't happen, you're going to be upset. So you need to make sure that your expectations are realistic. You need to communicate them accurately. Look, I'll have it ready, hopefully, but there might be some unforeseen things and so on. And of course, did we take those unforeseen circumstances into account? Okay, so expectations work both ways. You need to, sometimes people say, "You know what, if she doesn't do this by tonight, man, I'm really going to be pissed." Or if she shows up late again, well, did you ever tell her that? Does she know that, you know, people show up and all of a sudden they're in a war they didn't realize they were fighting, right? So expectations, you have to be realistic, and you also have to communicate them to other people as well in order to reduce this anger that happens. How come social workers get to go to conferences and we don't? You see this again in all kinds of departments. I'll give you this little story. When I, you know, was dealing with our budgets, we didn't have a training budget. So somebody raises their hand. How come when social workers want to go to a conference, they get their conference paid and we don't? And clearly, if that's the case, I would be upset too. So I said to them, "Well, see, social workers have a budget from McGill because they train undergraduates, and it costs time, so the university pays them. They use that money for training. For grad students, for masters in social work, they don't give them any money because they're doing work for us for free in exchange for the training. In psychology, we only have grad students, so we don't get any money from McGill. So the money isn't coming from us." Oh, okay. End of story, right? When I was a kid, I worked at the airport wearing one of these mobile canteens, wearing the paper hat, selling soft drinks and sandwiches. And there's no cash register. So what do? They give you 50 cups. At the end of the day, if you give them back 20 cups, you sold 30 drinks. So you've got to give them the money for 30 drinks. a simple system. Except people would come up to me, and old lady say, could you give me a cup? I want to get some water for my medicine. I said, I can't give it to you. Because, you know, that's how they count how many we sell and blah, blah, blah. How much is it? I said, it's the same as a drink. The empty cup is the same as a drink? And I would explain, I take my time to explain, because I didn't want them to go away shaking their head going, God, people in Montreal are robbing from people. So I went through this because I wanted them to understand and not feel as if it was unfair. Meanwhile, I had colleagues who says, same price as a drink. At the time, it was a quarter, right? Now, let's imagine $1.50 for a cup. You'd say, and you'd walk away thinking the world is unfair. So again, it requires a lot of explaining. I think it's worth the investment in telling people stories, in explaining to them. So are your perceptions accurate when you think things are unfair? Are you missing information? Are the people that are making decisions missing information? A lot of times we just assume, and as a result, when things don't turn out as we want, we feel that they're being unfair. Okay, very simply, when you're not happy with something, what are your choices? You can fix it, you can live with it, or you can leave. Right? Is there anything else? My salary isn't enough. I want more money. I don't have enough of my paycheck isn't big enough. Okay, you can ask for a raise. You get the raise, problem solved. My husband drinks. Tell him to stop. Okay, and he stops. Problem solved, right? In other words, when we're unhappy with our department, with our work, with our circumstances, we could try to negotiate, communicate. That should be the first thing we all do. Except that when we're hitting our heads against the wall and that nothing else is working, what's left? We can live with it, or we can walk away. So I tried to get my husband to stop, or I tried to ask for a raise, not getting it. But you know what? It's 5 minutes from home. I like the people I work with. It's not too stressful. I like what I do. I can pay my bills. Let it go. And you really, really need to let it go and accept in order to find peace. Or you can do the analysis and say, even though I'm working with people I like, and it's not far, and it's not very stressful, I can't pay my bills, I have no choice, you need to look for another job. And a lot of times, people are unhappy with what they have, they try and fix it, it's not working, they try and live with it, I can't stand it, it's making me crazy, and I can't go anywhere because who's going to want to hire me, who's going to want to be with me? Well, there's nothing else. So at some point, you have to choose one. You always need to do your best to fix your circumstances, but at some point, it doesn't help to just keep harping. You have to either accept it, and if you can't accept it, you need to walk away and do something else. And sometimes people are afraid of change, so they don't walk away, they don't look for anything else. They are bitter, they don't accept it, they feel hopeless, nothing's going to change, and then just it eats away at them inside. Sometimes you don't even have those choices, right? Doctor gives you a diagnosis of cancer, you can't say no thank you. Or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or whatever. So occasionally there's treatments. If there's treatments, okay, so I'll change it. Perfect. But if it's a terminal condition, well, you know, you have a brain tumor or you have whatever, you have early onset Alzheimer's and there's no cure for it, well, you can't say no, you can't change it, all you're left with is you have to accept it, right? And until you do, you won't find inner peace. So it's an important slide because I think many people are unhappy and they have a tendency sometimes to think, well, you know, I have job security, so I'll stay here. Well, you have to accept. Otherwise, good luck with that. So I'll leave you with some random thoughts. Number one, this issue of job security. Well, I have my job, I don't want to lose my seniority. If you're miserable and you got 10 more years or 20 more years to go, A, you're going to live 20 years of misery, but you're also going to cause 20 years of misery to people around you. So job security is a good thing, But if you're skilled, you will find work elsewhere. So at some point, we get trapped in this model of, well, you know, I don't want to lose my benefits. But why are you here, right? You're here in order to function and be happy. It's an important part of well-being. And without satisfaction at work, then life is a living hell. So what price are you paying for that benefit? Viruses can spread and infect an entire department. So it's important to, you know, really address problems before it becomes too late. It's easy to just, you know, go, you know, take advantage of the go-to guy or you know, ignore the person who isn't pulling their weight. And sometimes you can't do much about it. But usually there are things you can do. We tend to take the default option and do less until we're forced to. So I do think some people also resist change because they think that it's bad. Well, it's not all bad. At the same time, it's not all good either. Some people just do change for change's sake. So here's an important issue then. You have to be able to distinguish between a naysayer and a critical thinker. Whenever you try and engage in change, you say, oh, there's always going to be people who resist. It's true. There are going to be people who resist. Some people are going to say no to everything. And you can't do anything about that other than, you know, just manage around it. But there are going to be people who have important points to consider. The ones who think critically and say and anticipate problems and so on. And if you're a manager, you need to be able to distinguish between the people who just say no all the time and the people who have good ideas. And that, again, requires you not to lump everyone together, not to think in groups, right? To distinguish between the two. So, two final thoughts. If you're an employee, you know, it's not as if we look around at all the employees and say, who is the most incompetent person here? I'm going to make them a manager. You know, there are people who assume that all managers are idiots. Usually we pick people to manage because they're good employees and, you know, they tend to be pretty smart and pretty sharp individuals. It is true that sometimes we take whoever's available, whoever's willing to take all the lumps. But for the most part, they're good employees. At the same time, it's a difficult skill because doing is one thing and making people do is another skill. Faire et de faire faire. And managing people is not the same as being a good IT worker and so on. So sometimes they have a learning curve as well. But the bottom line is that it's not as if we deliberately choose incompetent people. You also are there to help them. So you got to start with a relationship of trust. Because if you label them immediately as administration, then right away you're setting up this antagonistic relationship. But to the managers, the employees are not all idiots either. Okay? The fact is that you both contribute. I don't know how many are managers here, how many are employees. But the bottom line is that in a relationship of mutual trust, you generally are going to go much farther. When you start setting up labels, us versus them, those kinds of things, you end up losing sight of the individual and just looking at the label. Individuals rarely, I mean, whatever you say about guys, about girls, and so on and so forth, rarely does any generalization apply to an individual. Same thing happens with employees-employer relationships. Okay, thank you for indulging me. I took an extra few minutes. But just so you know, if you're interested, I have a blog. You can read it. There's stuff on stress management and so on, and depression and burnout. There's my website. There's a link to my blog if you want. And of course, if you want to follow me on Twitter, good luck. I'm not going to tweet very often. But I do have a Twitter account that can say I've joined the 21st century. So, all right, that's it. Thank you very much. So I think what the next plan is that there's going to be, I guess you can ask questions of your managers or of your directors and of me if you wish, whatever, we'll all be here to...
So we invited the director.
invite you to go to the MIT and ask them. And if you want to see comments or things like that, you're more than welcome.
Oh, that's who all the people, all the ones are.
And somebody asked a question, and then somebody.
All the people are dressed fancy.
Okay. You may have the question. Ah, Vicky, come on. Oh.
Is that the window? My microphone is not on.
All right. Dr. Zacchia, one of the things that you had talked about was. That we don't want to obsess over all the risks and trying to gain control. Is it true then that you can live in blissful ignorance? if we're looking for happiness, should we not be delving? Is it better to be unprepared?
Well, is my, hello? Okay. That's why I talked about doubt. To me, it's not about being bliss. I mean, obviously ignorance is bliss, but ignorance also could lead to a lot of problems. It's the issue of lowering your standards. I do believe that you need to be concerned about doing things right. We exercise, we eat well, we follow medical advice because it does make us happy, but at the same time, the people who want that perfection, the ones who say, but what about this, what about that, they're constantly plagued by all the things that could go wrong, because things could go wrong. So in the two tools, you know, you in the Batman's belt story, obviously you need to control as much as you can within reason. Within reason. There's always going to be stuff that you're going to have to adapt to. Otherwise you can't adapt to change. So confidence in your ability to deal with unforeseen is a key. But that comes with the ability to accept that things sometimes will turn out badly. Otherwise, if you can't accept that, you know, let's say you're going to have a car accident, then you go back to try and anticipate all the things that can happen. So ultimately, it is about being aware of potential dangers, not being ignorant. But at the same time, if you don't pay any attention, you'll be blissfully happy until a disaster happens. So you want to avoid as many disasters as a reasonable person can.
So it depends on the probability of the risk,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, look.
But you have to do that math first.
Apparently she worked with our quantitative psychologists, and we were in graduate school a couple of years from each other in the same department. So I thought she looked familiar. But
So now I'll turn the question to our IT folk and say, all right, so one of the things that we do when we build new systems is we have to test. We have to look for those risks. We have to try to control that, to mitigate that. And we can take a long, long time and test very thoroughly and put in something that's perfect, or we can test less well and put in something that's really buggy. And we're trying to find that happy medium of what's reasonable, with the expectation, I assume then, that some things will go in that will not be perfect. We will have bugs with our users. And it used to be that it was easier to respond to that. I think we felt more comfortable with the bugs because we didn't have as much overhead in making changes. We could turn them around more quickly. Now we've got more approvals and so on, and so a bug that when it happens stays in the system longer. And that's where I think maybe some of our tendency is then to say we need to test more because we can't respond as quickly. Do you have any comment to that or advice as to how we should deal with that?
Yeah, microphone is here.
So I think that goes back to the good enough. At some point, you're right. You know, and I think the examples you were giving also, it's relative. If you're building a spaceship, you'll test a lot, because once you're in the you're gone, there's nothing much you can do. So in those cases, you'll tend to go to the extreme. In other cases, they are mitigating, you can mitigate the errors, you can have workarounds, you have different things. So It's always you have to have that measure. And it's the same thing when you when you design your solutions. We tend to want to handle any possible exception, any possible instances that may happen someday, one day, and sometimes that's overkill. So there's always that balance. So I think in any cases, it's always trying to put ourselves at the proper place. The issue I see also in terms of going, so saying, well, whatever our user asks, we do, is often we're not handling the real problem. We're not looking at the root cause. We're not trying to identify, well, why is there this issue? What am I trying to correct? Is that really going to correct the problem? Because there are bugs that are really bugs, you know, it's just not working. But in other cases, it's just that it is working, but it's not working as we would expect or as we would want. I found it interesting. You gave me that example in a meeting on an application we built that's used by faculty, and that one faculty member was saying, it's really interesting. That application does exactly what our policy says. But our policy is wrong. We're not following. We didn't used to follow our policy. So yeah, we have this new application. It's fine. It really respects our policy, but it's not what we want. So when we were doing manually, we would do whatever, what we wanted to do. So it's a very interesting example you were giving where we're doing something properly, but it's not really what people wanted. And why did we do it properly is because we talked to the people who do the policy. We didn't speak to the people who were actually applying those policies. So that's also an issue in terms of who do we talk to, where do we get that information from. And then again, the people who do the policy say, well, you can't do a system that does not respect policy. Right again. So it's a balance. I think one of the things that I really liked of this morning presentation is that there is no absolute truth. You know, you position yourself on a continuum between, let's say, total relax and total control, and you'll never be at either end. You'll be somewhere in between. You just have to find the right fit for the situation we're in, and that's where the good enough comes in. And we have to kind of look for that to have balance in our lives between work and family, between...
It's about efficiency.
Yeah.
Obviously, aircraft's very safe because so much is at stake, much more so than cars can break down, but airplanes can't break down without costing lives. So, you know, unfortunately, some people apply the same standards across the board. So obviously, it's a cost-benefit analysis. At what point, what is the need for this, and how efficient does it need to be versus something else? When do you really torque it up? And that's the idea of the perfectionism, really doing the important things the proper way by prioritizing and choosing your battles and so on. And you know, when people want to have over control things, then they lose sight of that efficiency analysis.
Other questions? No?
But I'm not going to ask all of them. Somebody else has to ask them. I thought it was a wonderful presentation, and I really appreciate you setting this up, bringing Dr. Zaghi here. But I do have a question to say, is this because of all the change we've had, or are we expecting another load of change?
That's the mistrust part. No, we're not. Well, to my knowledge, to my knowledge, there is no announced change coming up. But, you know, we... 3 months ago, we had a government that was saying that they would reinvest the money they already took away. But that government is not there anymore. The new government says, oh, we're not so sure, underfunding, maybe not, blah, blah, blah. So will there be money? Probably not. So we don't know. But currently, We've had substantial cuts. We've put in place mechanisms to absorb those cuts. We did the early retirement program. I think that brought a huge change in our own unit, but in other units also. And to my knowledge, there is no following big cut coming. But what's going to happen next week, in 6 months, in a year, we don't know. It's just, and it's reality. So there will be other changes. We're going to start new projects. We're going to do new things. You know, but as it is today now, I have nothing in my back pocket.
You know, occasionally people are, you know, a person responsible for a department is handed something. You know, they don't choose these things. Governments change. You know, people bang pots in streets and so on, and all of a sudden we're stuck with a political decision that's going to affect all of us. And if a manager is looking at, you know, several hundred thousand dollar cut, is looking at the tableau, chances are if all of you were looking over this person's shoulder or were, you know, mandated to make the decision, sometimes there are pretty obvious things that need to be addressed, and we'd all agree. And if it's your challenge, you probably would answer it the same way as the other person. I mean, because you're not looking at the detail, you have a tendency to think that they've got some nefarious plans and goals behind them. The truth is that something like that is never going to be good. I think if the person is willing to talk to open, flexible people, listen to suggestions, and you're trusting that the person's going to do the best given their constraints and circumstances. Like, it's never going to be perfect, but I think the more you have this transparency, this communication, this relationship of trust, the more people are going to absorb changes and say, look, you know, it's not her, it's political and so on and so forth, or it's not him, it's the reality of our society. These are society choices, and you can't always blame the person who is the messenger.
So, is there another Vicky? Okay, well, thank you all.